Welcome to Hope is Not a Strategy, the podcast featuring fascinating strategy stories from the past, present, and future. My name is Christian Underwood, and in conversation with real strategy makers, we aim to demystify the myth of strategy and show how strategic work can help you win in these volatile times. And today, we're speaking with a man who is a professor of technology management, Asia business, and comparative management at INSEAD Business School in Fontainebleau. He wrote the book Built to Innovate and has been the former Dean of the Executive Education at INSEAD. So welcome, Ben Bensau.
Well, good afternoon, Christian. And thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you. I hope I got everything right. And you have so many titles, absolutely. Visiting professorships. But for all of those who want to get to know that, should go directly to your profiles.
Absolutely.
But your profession and your main interest is innovation. And therefore, we're talking today because innovation is an integral part of, you know, refining your business and should be part of strategy. And in your book, you had kind of a new approach that I thought maybe could be interesting to all of our listeners. And therefore, I think it's really great if we talk about innovation as a core competency of the company. Could you give us a short description of what your book is all about? Because there's so many innovation books out there, but what is special about your book?
If I may, what I want to do is to really share a whole new different view of innovation, a different kind of narrative about innovation, which is very different from, let's call it the Anglo-Saxon kind of California startup kind of view of innovation. And what I want to share maybe is how you hardwire innovation in a company's DNA, in a company's fabric. So this is what is really different. And again, just to elaborate just a little bit, this is about how I would say traditional established companies or even organizations operating in, you know, all type of businesses can innovate.
So maybe in the German Mittelstand, the hidden champions, and it's maybe how they did or doing innovation.
Absolutely. Again, you know, if I were to kind of summarize, I mean, you were talking about all the different visiting and all that. I mean, this was usually a journey for research. So I would say it's about like 20 years I've been doing research and teaching on innovation. And for this, I've studied, I would say, like in depth, close to 100 organizations around the globe, of course, in the private sector, but also in the public sector. And I looked at many different industries. Startups, of course, you cannot avoid looking at startups, but I spent time with small and medium-sized companies. And of course, you know, I went to Japan and Korea and other places where they have like these large industrial conglomerates. So this is really for, I mean, you know, the companies that you're referring to, you know, established, very often like smaller family-owned businesses. They have these innovating capabilities lying around the organization. And this is more about how do you tap into and leverage this capability from everyone in the organization.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I was really, really keen of or interested in, because when you're saying what is the Anglo-Saxon, Anglo-American idea of innovation, it's about disruption, about the great big ideas that turn around the world. And in your approach, it's more about the small little ideas that change in the end, multiplied so many different things.
It's a lot about the little ideas. It's about the little processes, the habits. So I don't know, maybe I don't know if you would like me to do this, but just to anchor conversation.
Please go on,
I could just kind of give you two kind of examples. And from that, I can actually, you know, talk about what's the difference between the California heroic kind of, you know, super super innovator model and what I'm talking about. Maybe people know about a company called Starwood. This is a hospitality, a hotel company. I mean, they own the Sheraton and a whole chain of hotels. A few years ago, they organized a global conference in Paris for 700 of their hotel managers. So what we did is that we gave them a brief introduction to basic concepts of innovation and, you know, introduced them to a few tools. And then what we did is that we split them into 64 groups. Then we gave them, train tickets. We gave them notepads and cameras. And then we sent them out to walk around the streets of Paris to just kind of, observe experiences, take pictures, try to get some insights from ordinary travelers. Now, what is interesting is that 3 hours later, we asked them to come back. And they came back with like some fascinating ideas and all sorts of insights. So they generated, listen to this, Christian, they generated 1,700 new ideas.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Let's be careful. Huh? Many of these ideas were, small improvements to some existing processes or services. But in that, they generated some things that became the foundation to a global initiative for Starwood. Just like one example, just to capture people's imagination, they developed a marketing program, which is called Fantastic. And this is a special program to develop special packages for families. These packages are based on research done on what children dream about a hotel experience.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And this was a huge success. But now the important thing here is to say that out of these 700 people, none of them was a specialist of innovation. Everyone understood that if you just step away from your daily routine, and if you immerse yourself, even for just an hour or two, in the life of your customer, that opens up a floodgate of fresh ideas. So this is to kind of tell you what I'm talking about. This is the kind of behavior and processes that you can put in place to tap the innovating capability of everyone. So let me give you a quick other example, and then I will tell you what are the principles that I'm trying to share.
Yeah, sure.
Again, people will probably know about this company. It's Fiskars. It's a Finnish company. It's 400 years old. It's a 400 years old, of course, family company in the beginning. They're very famous for their iconic orange scissors. They make a whole range of cutting tools, tableware, outdoor equipment for gardening, and all sorts of other things. And for me, this is a very good example of what I'm talking about. This is a very old company. We agree.
Absolutely.
And this company able to proactively enter a completely new industry just by using their very methodical, systematic, continuous approach to innovation. So just a quick example. They wanted to understand, for people who are familiar with design thinking, they wanted to understand the job to be done by their home gardeners. So what they did is that they conducted an in-depth exploration, ethnographic exploration, into the life of of a gardener. So they tried to look at what happens before, what happens during, and what happens after people have used Fiskars tools. And during this research, they made a significant discovery. They discovered that watering was an essential part of the whole gardening experience. It was an integral part of what home gardeners do. And they also realized that they, as Fiskars, they already had the design and the technologies to be able to develop a watering solution that none of the current players in the industry could even think about. Instead of opting for the wall-mounted racks, people have a rack that is on the wall, and they store their hose around it. So they developed a new kind of all-in-one standalone product. They called it the water wheel. So it's just like a carry-on suitcase. It has it's fitted with wheels. It has 300-degree rotation movement, and it has all sorts of accessories. If you want to water a plot of land for a long time, or if you want to set up a a play area for the kids. Mm-hmm. Now, the water wheel won many design awards, and it became a very profitable new product line in the lineup of products for Fiskars. And actually, it made them become a very reputable and successful company known for its innovating capabilities. So now the question, I mean, I just kind of tried to give you a couple examples of what I'm talking about. So now the question is, how do we get better at innovation? And learning from these companies, I realized that to get better at innovation, we somewhat need a different narrative. I mean, genius-led and radical disruptive innovation, it can be very hard. Not every company can be like Tesla or Amazon or Apple. So, and this is the reason why I thought it was very important to introduce a new narrative about innovation and change the way we think about innovation. So there's like, you know, first there's three myths that I've noticed talking to people in the companies. One, there's this notion that innovation is a domain of some superheroes, innovation superheroes, people who somewhat have some sort of a special talent. But that's not true. I mean, when you hear the story about Starwood, you see that innovation is for everyone. Anyone can innovate. Innovating is something that can be learned. It doesn't require any special talent. So number one, anyone can innovate. Second, this, again, heroic notion that innovation is all about big bang, breakthrough, disruptive innovation. We saw, again, if you think about Fiskars, is a very good example of a company that was able to enter a new industry. It did not disrupt anything, but it was able to enter a different industry. And they did this thanks to their very continuous and systematic approach to innovation. Another myth also that I see around is that innovation is the responsibility of senior leaders or some specialists within the organization. Very often in manufacturing, they call it R&D. But then again, that's not necessarily true. The whole organization can actually contribute to innovation. And again, the two small examples that I shared with you, you can see that the real heroes of innovation are the ones who are at the front line.
Yeah, absolutely.
The fourth element I like to add to this narrative, innovation is not only happening inside out, internally, but also outside in, learning, I mean, coming from the customer, learning, and it is all about listening, discovering, and addressing the needs of customers and something also that I call the non-customers. Mm-hmm. And the final thing about this different narrative about innovation is that innovation is for any kind of company. It is not only about high-tech and sexy startups. Any organization, as a matter of fact, even public services and government agencies can innovate. All companies can innovate. So this is really, when you ask me what's different from the traditional view of innovation, that it is done by geniuses, it is big bang. So this is a much more focused on everybody in the organization contributing to the innovation. Mm-hmm. And you can enter new markets, because sometimes, you know, especially when I go to Japan, people start to ask me, but is this different from incremental improvement? Mm-hmm. Well, you see, historically, we've been caught, I would say, between these two polar views of innovation.
Sure.
So you had the Japanese who had invented incremental improvement. Mm-hmm. So really like, you know, a small step at a time.
With Toyota, for example. Yeah.
Yes, but it was improvement to something that already existed. Mm-hmm. And then you had the other extreme, you know, the disruption, you know, you create a completely new industry.
Yes.
And we didn't have anything in between. Mm-hmm. But you could see the story of Fiskars. They are not improving. They're entering a new market. They're entering a new industry. And they've done it using a process.
So trust the process. That's the first message. And a second one, which I really liked, and especially when, you know, we're working a lot with medium-sized companies, especially in Germany, Switzerland, and Austria. And I think they lost their confidence, their self-confidence, that they can really do innovation and not just doing the old boring stuff. So, and therefore, I really like your approach in giving back them their self-confidence that they are all doing innovation. And also, it's my kind of an idea that, you know, it's creativity and creative problem solving is part of the human DNA.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think this is something very fundamental that you say, Christian. I don't know if this will capture people's imagination, but my view is that people go to work, you know, they accomplish the task that they are asked for. And usually this is what I call execution. They're executing their job very well.
Yes.
And they're trained, they have the tools and everything. But there's a big part of their brain, like you call it the creative, the creative brain, it's almost as if when they walk into the office or in the shop floor, they turn it off.
Yes.
And they start to execute. And in fact, there's this huge capability in every employee. We know people are creative. I mean, I don't want to talk about how children are creative, right? Yes. I mean, you know, people have this creative capability, but the thing is that when they join a company, they're told what job they have to do, and they shut off this creative thing. So the first thing they need to do is they need to be given permission. Because it is there. I mean, people who are doing their job, they're facing, especially people who face a customer. By the way, when I talk about innovation, I'm talking as well about internal innovation and external innovation. This is the other thing about the old narrative. You know, we think that innovation is all about product, it's about technology, it's about external customer. No, but, you know, you can innovate in HR. You can innovate in logistics. You can innovate internally, externally. Many people, when they do their work, they have many, many different types of customers. So it's really about how people can be given the permission to bring their ideas. Now, they have a lot of ideas, but they don't know how to communicate them. They don't know how to formulate them. They don't know how to codify them. So it's just a question of giving them some tools to make them capable of, you know, bringing their ideas and bringing them back to the company and sharing it with them. And then, of course, the last point, you know, that is important for people to really start to innovate and to, you know, put into practice their creativity is that they need to be acknowledged for it. So they need, like I said, they need to be given permission. They need to be given, they need to feel capable. They need tools, time, resources, but then they need to be recognized. If people come up with an idea and people ignore them, or, you know, they're not supported or they're not recognized for it, I mean, people will bring you, you know, will bring you an idea or two. And then they say, well, you know, Christian doesn't care. He doesn't care about all this. So I'm not going to do it anymore. So this is really what I found fascinating about these companies is that you had all of this small, you know, I mean, and anyway, I say small, but, you know, innovation is one thing where an idea, you'll never know if it's going to be small or big until you implement it. So you have all of these ideas lying around the company that stays in the mind of the people, and you're not leveraging it. You're not tapping it. And so this is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the end, when we're talking about that kind of creativity and giving people room to speak about it and transfer it to real business, we have on the other side, it's about the conformity that we're talking about, which, you know, shared value, doing the job you've given to. And when we bring now the idea of conformity and creativity in, let's say, the German business world, and also maybe the Japanese or Asian model, do you see any comparison there of German and Japanese companies?
Absolutely, absolutely. Maybe at a higher extent in Japanese and German firm. And you can see that they're very good at executing and improving on execution. And in a sense, you know, this creativity thing is a little bit running against that. So for me, and again, I'm just kind of picking up from what I saw, observing this, you know, companies that transform themselves. I mean, when I talk about Starwood or Fiskars, and there are many others in the book, these are companies that proactively transform themselves into becoming more innovative. When I started to kind of, you know, open the hood and look inside what was happening, what I found is exactly what you're saying, is that they're very good at doing certain things, executing. And when they were doing this creative work and innovative work, it was done in a different space. So, in the end, I discovered that they were not operating with one engine. They were operating with two engines. Just like, you know, a jet plane, if you will.
So, like a dual mode.
Yes, dual mode. And but dual in the sense that these two twin engines, they are functioning, they're operating in parallel and simultaneously. Mm-hmm. So you have, you know, what everybody knows about the execution engine. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the execution engine is focused on the strategy of today. We're trying to execute the strategy of today. It is focused on beating the competition and being the best in the industry. Efficiency. Mm. So it's all about what I call supply side view.
Yes.
And fundamentally, it is about problem solving. Mm-hmm. Then what I saw this company is that they would proactively create, however small it is, it doesn't have to be a big thing, but they would create, and I can describe how they did this, they would create this separate space, which, you know, I gave it a name, innovating engine. Mm-hmm. So they have this innovating space, which is very concrete. This is dedicated. This is fully legitimized, protected space. And now the innovating engine, the focus is on building the strategy of tomorrow. Mm. This is about developing and testing the ideas for the products and processes and services of the future. And now when you compare with the execution engine, the focus is not on beating the competition. In fact, when you are trying to innovate, you know what? The competition is irrelevant. Don't worry about the competition. Don't look what the competition doing. You have to focus on the customer and the non-customer. And people make a mistake. They think that innovation is about problem solving. It's not about execution is about problem solving. Innovating, as I call it, it's about problem finding. It's about being focused on the customer and the non-customer and try to generate as many new problems that you can about the customer. So you can see these two engines are functioning simultaneously. And this means that every employee in the company, they have to be given permission and they are supported, they're encouraged to spend some time in some form, some time doing some innovating activity. You remember Starwood, they would go for an hour. Go for an hour every 2-3 months and just sit there and look at the customer. What is the customer doing? What is happening? Maybe every 2 months, we could have like a little, you know, brainstorming, you know. So everybody at their scale, and I'm saying everybody, I mean, from the top to the bottom, people should be engaged in some form of, I call it, innovating activity. And maybe this is where, if it's okay, I can make this distinction between innovating and innovation.
Yeah, absolutely. I really love your saying, stop innovation, start innovating. So that's a pretty good one.
So I think this is important because I'm being very careful in my language. I'm saying people should get involved in innovating activities. The story goes like this. I mean, I've been teaching innovation for many, many years. As many of these things, you know, it happened by accident. Mm-hmm. I noticed that when I use the word innovation, I realize that the word innovation as a noun, I mean, in German, you have nouns,
yes,
right?
Yes.
As a noun, it is very intimidating. Mm-hmm. And it tends to trigger, you know, anxiety and stress for people, especially people who are at the front line.
Sure.
You know, they think, oh, I'm not very creative, you know. And then, to tell you the truth, when people come to a training, innovation training, very quickly I realize that they're sitting there and they assume in their head that their boss, expects them now to come up with the next breakthrough product or to go back to the company and to be able to uncover a new market space. And I can feel it, you know, I can feel the tension, the pressure in the room. And I feel like they hate this. They hate
this. Absolutely. Yeah.
So the day I discovered this, then this kind of behavior, I decided not to use the word innovation anymore. Instead, I refer to innovating. Now, this is the verb form.
Sure.
I think you have the verb form in
yeah,
German,
sure.
right? Or I use the word to innovate. We're not here to learn about innovation. We are here to learn about how to innovate. And then, you know, I can feel the tension disappear in the room. The reason why, I think, is because innovating does not imply a result.
Sure. It's the process.
Yes, absolutely. Mm. People imagine when I say innovating, it refers to a process, to, you know, behaviors, attitudes. And these are things that can be taught. It can be taught. So for me, again, just to make it clear for people who listen, innovating for me, not innovation, no? Innovating for me is very simple. It's about looking for new ideas.
And they can be everywhere and everyone can do it.
You just look for new ideas, right. And you look for new ideas, you develop them, you test them with no guarantee as to what you will find.
Sure.
You have no guarantee. So you're just looking for new ideas. Of course, they have to create value for a customer and for the company. So, and I can see that with this approach, it gives permission to people in the room to try their hand at some innovating activity, right? As I say, you know, very few of us are geniuses who can come up with like breakthrough insights, you know, on command, you know? But getting engaged in some activity, you know, observing a customer, collecting information, paying attention to things, you know, having a conversation with people across the company, with the customers, the non-customers. You know, in essence, innovating can be learned. It can be learned and it can be supported by tools and guided with processes.
Yes.
So I think this is really what I'm talking about. So you need to create a space where people are, of course, they're doing the execution job.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, as I say, if you don't execute well, if you don't protect the business of today, and you think that you can imagine the future, well, guess what? You might not be there in the future.
Yeah, because you have no money for those experiments.
Exactly. So it is important to execute well. And this is why, as you say, the Japanese and the German companies are very good, very well disciplined. They have very strict processes. People know what they do. But then you have to create this little space that is totally protected, fully legitimized, where people are encouraged to... You know, the importance is that it's regularity. It's not that they have to spend a lot of time. Maybe the R&D people, they do that all their day, you know? But all the other people, they can spend some time doing something that triggers, like you say, their creative mind, you know? And then you help them, you give them tools to know how to explain it to other people, how to codify it, and how to put it in some sort of a bank, you know? Where people will start to, you know, test the ideas and find out which ones are good. So, but for me, it's the habit. It's creating a habit in the mind of everyone in the company that innovating is also part of their job.
And from each and everyone in the company. Thank you very much, Ben, for giving back the confidence and also, allow everyone in the organization to think about and do, not innovation, innovating in each and everything they may be doing and giving them, also some space and, also maybe some routines of doing it on a regular basis, which helps to get some space to think about those kind of things. So therefore, thank you very much. And just as a last question, we're always looking for a really, really concrete advice. There were so many advices that you've already given. But now as a, yeah, maybe for some business leaders out there who wants to start this new kind of, let's say, innovating approach from you, what is the first step that they should do?
I mean, for me, it's really the, in one word, is to give permission.
Okay.
To give permission and encourage people and protect them. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important is to protect them. Actually, if you allow me, I'll just tell you one last story.
Yeah, sure.
And it's a Japanese story about one word that could encapture what I'm trying to talk about. This is a Japanese company called Recruit. This is somebody I trained in this approach methodology in 2002. So I gave the training and I went back, you know, 4 or 5 months later, you know, to just find out what they had done with it. And then when I was starting to interview people, they kind of said, oh, wow, the manager, after your training, he started to behave in a strange way. And I said, what do you mean in a strange way? He said, oh, he keeps saying thank you. And I was really intrigued. You know, already in Japan, you say thank you a lot, but he was saying thank you in a strange way. So I went to see him. He explained to me. So whenever somebody came to his office or in a meeting and somebody kind of wanted to, you know, propose a new idea or have a kind of a creative thought, he would, every time he would systematically say, thank you, you know, and insist, thank you. And I asked him, why do you say that? And you know what? He said, you know, I discovered one thing. When people are doing their job, they're executing their job, right? So it's structured. There's a job description, there are tools, there are KPIs. So they know that when they are executing their job, their boss, at any time, he can know if they're doing well or not. So lots of visibility. But when it comes to creativity, he said, I have no visibility. I don't know if somebody has an idea or not. They could have a brilliant idea and keep it in their head and never tell me about it. Or he said, you know, jokingly, they tell me about it on their retirement day, you know? and then he said, you know, the reason is that because they understand that, when they propose an idea, they take a risk. You know, they could be rejected. People may make fun of them. So he said to me, when people are coming to me or they make a suggestion of an idea in a meeting, they're taking a big risk. So for me, when they come to me with an idea, I take it as a gift. They're taking a big risk. And he said to me, in my culture, when people, you know, give you a gift, you say thank you. So here it is for your listeners to encourage innovation. Each time somebody comes up with an idea, bad or good or whatever, say thank you. Thank you for sharing your most private, most, you know, precious thing, which is your creativity.
I think everything's said, and the only thing I can say now, Ben, is thank you. Thank you very much for your
All
great
right,
idea.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot.